You are now listening to the OrthoBullets podcast.
This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will be another adapted OrthoBullets core webinar from the OrthoBullets core curriculum, and this one will cover proximal third tibia fractures from the trauma section. The topic will be reviewed by Dr. Jan Zakowski, who is an orthopedic trauma surgeon at the Andrews Institute for Orthopedics and Sports Medicine in Florida.
Once again, we're going to start with proximal third tibia fractures. These fractures have a very high rate of malunion, and this is often both tested as well as seen in practice. We're talking about the valgus as well as apex anterior or procurvatum malunion. These fractures are fairly common, 5 to 11% of all tibial shaft fractures when we're talking about the proximal one-third tibia fractures. Pathophysiology, just like any fracture, we're going to have both a low energy and a high energy mechanism. Low energy usually is the result of torsional injury. High energy, they're going to be direct trauma. We're going to be thinking about soft tissue compromise, a lot of comminution at the fracture site. Associated conditions, just like any fracture, but especially with tibia fractures, think about compartment syndrome. Think about the soft tissue injury. It's going to be critical to the outcome. The tibia, as you know, is a bone with relatively poor muscle coverage, and it's going to be prone to soft tissue injury as well as a compromise. So when we're talking about the osteology or the bone makeup of the proximal tibia, remember it's going to be triangular in shape, and there's going to be a metaphyseal-diaphyseal mismatch. What does that mean? Well, it means there's going to be a wide metaphyseal region followed by a narrow canal. This makes the tibia very prone to malunions, especially when using a device such as an implant such as a nail to fix these fractures. In terms of the deforming forces, we're going to be thinking about this for any type of fracture, but in the proximal tibia, we're going to go over some of these that really make a big difference, both in the reduction and fixation. The first is going to be the pull of the patellar tendon or extensor mechanism. This pulls the proximal fragment into flexion, making that apex anterior deformity that we often see as a malunion. And then the hamstring tendons can pull the distal fragment as well into flexion, making both these deformity malunion of, once again, of the procurvatum, apex anterior, and valgus. So the deforming forces also include the pes. The pes can pull the proximal fragment in varus, causing a valgus deforming force of the fracture. Remember, when we're thinking about, when we say the malunions in valgus, that's the distal part of the tibia that we're looking at, not the proximal part. So the distal tibia will go into valgus, and that's what you will many times see on x-rays and in the operating room. The anterior compartment musculature as well can put a valgus deforming force of the fracture site, and all these deforming forces must be counteracted while we're trying to both reduce the fracture and finally fix it. In terms of the classification, we're not going to spend too much time on this. Type A is going to be a simple fracture pattern. Type B, a wedge fracture pattern, and a type C is going to be a comminuted fracture pattern. So, presentation, and this is going to be basically for any fracture, especially a weight of a weight-bearing bone, and that's going to be pain and the inability to bear weight. We got to start with the physical examination, especially with a subcutaneous bone like the tibia. Think about inspecting it, palpating it, looking for any issues with the skin, such as blisters, open wounds. Always check the compartments. Tibia fractures are known for having compartment syndrome, and you've got to remember, if it's to palpate, to feel how tense the muscles are, if the patient has pain out of proportion to their exam, and then if clinically indicated, if you're not sure if there's a compartment syndrome, then someone will need to check an intracompartmental pressure. But many times, compartment syndrome is going to be a clinical diagnosis, not necessarily always needing those compartments checked in terms of their pressure. In terms of the physical exam as well, think about the neurologic exam. You're going to be checking for all these nerves, the deep peroneal nerve, superficial peroneal nerve, the sural, tibial, and saphenous nerve distribution as well. Pulse, dorsalis pedis, and posterior tibia, you want to be checking on these, making sure that they're going to be symmetric to the contralateral side. If they're not, it may warrant further investigation, especially with proximal third tibia fractures, where the trifurcation of the arterial supply to the lower limb can be placed on tension and be injured with these fracture patterns. In terms of radiographs, always remember, get the joint above and below the injury. Okay. In terms of a CT, if there's any question of intra-articular fracture extension, I think this is a good idea, especially when you're dealing with proximal and distal tibia fractures. Non-operative treatment of proximal tibia fractures, we're thinking about closed reduction and cast immobilization. The indications for this are similar to tibial shaft fractures, which we're going to go over later, but they're usually closed low energy fractures with acceptable alignment. What's acceptable alignment? A lot of times this likes to be ass, and that's going to be less than 5 degrees varus valgus angulation, 10 degrees in the anterior posterior plane. You got to have more than 50% of cortical apposition and less than 1 centimeter of shortening. So for short oblique fractures that are prone to shortening, usually closed treatment is not going to be very acceptable. And then also 10 degrees of less than 10 degrees of rotational male alignment when compared to the contralateral side. And it's always going to be key. Use the other side as a guide if possible. And then the technique, well, the technique is going to be something that patients do not like. They're going to be placed in a long leg cast and then converted to a functional brace at about 4 weeks. You want to cast in about 10 to 20 degrees of flexion because it's very hard to ambulate with a fully extended limb. It's very hard to sit in a car, sit in a chair. But once again, patients do not tolerate very well non-operative treatment of tibia shaft and proximal tibia fractures many times. It's also very hard to hold a reduction of a proximal tibia fracture within a cast, especially the rotational control, and there's a lot of issues. So once again, not always a preferred treatment. So operative treatment, okay? Think about external fixation. The indications, fractures with extensive soft tissue compromise, whether this be a fine wire fixator or a multiplane external fixator, these can be very useful with some of these fracture patterns. And also with the polytrauma patient as well, it helps us get a moving, stabilized soft tissue until they can be definitively fixed. So, first question of the night. Okay, so a fracture in the following location is most commonly associated with procurvatum, so apex anterior, and valgus male alignment. Well, since we're doing the tibia fracture talk tonight, I think we can narrow it down to either proximal tibia or distal third tibia shaft fractures with intact fibula. We've just gone over in terms of what the answer should be, and I think most of us should be getting this right, and that's going to be the proximal tibia. Right, and like we talked about there's going to be the valgus and apex anterior male alignment is going to be the most common male alignment for these fractures. Remember, the pull of the patellar tendon pulls that proximal piece into extension, the hamstring pulls the distal piece into flexion, as well as the pes pulls the proximal piece in varus, which makes a distal valgus male alignment. So just be thinking about all these things that we just went over about the fracture deformity and all those muscle forces. What can we do to stop this, though? Well, we're going to go over all these, but just to give you a brief interlude, we're going to be talking about blocking screws. We're going to be talking about the using a semi-extended knee position or suprapatellar nailing, and then even using a slightly more lateral starting point and the application of a unicortical plate as well. All these techniques can help us really prevent the malalignment of these fractures. So, operative treatment indications: there's got to be enough bone to accept the nail and to have the cross screws through the nail. So we're talking about 5 to 6 centimeters. This is changing with some newer implants. Outcomes: high rates of male union, and the most common male union we've talked about: valgus, apex anterior. I think we've said that now several times, so hopefully it's going to be really sticking every time you see one of these proximal tibia fractures. Another thing that we can do is the percutaneous lock plating. This is really good to use, especially when you have inadequate proximal fixation for a nail. Many times it's a short segment, and you want to get multiple points of fixation, and that's why a locking plate can be oftentimes used with great success. It can be used medial or laterally. We often use them laterally because that's where a lot of times their percutaneous guides are made for it, but medial can be used too, especially if there's soft tissue issues. Medially, they tend to be a little bit more prominent and require harder removal more often. So outcomes, well, lateral plating with the medial comminution can lead to varus collapse, and that's because there's no support here medially along the medial cortex. Long plates can place the superficial peroneal nerve at risk. This has been tested before. The longer the plate you use, especially when you're getting 10, 12, 13 holes, you want to expose the distal segment and actually see where the plate is and not just blindly place screws there. So surgical technique for intramedullary nailing, we can use a few different techniques, not just the semi-extended suprapatellar technique. We can use a lateral parapatellar approach, helps maintain reduction for proximal one-third fractures, requires a mobile patella. You got to move it out of the way. And this is one of the issues of using a medial parapatellar approach with these fractures. It can sometimes lead to a more medial starting point and lead to that valgus deformity. And that's because the patella is pushing your hand, pushing the guide wire medially, and you're not getting the ideal starting point. Suprapatellar facilitates nailing in a semi-extended position. This can sometimes help counteract some of the deforming forces of the extensor mechanism. The ideal entry point is just going to be medial to the lateral tibial spine in the AP view and anterior to the anterior articular margin. You don't want it in the joint. You want it just anterior to the joint, right? Because you don't want to have excessive reaming posteriorly that can affect the meniscus, and you don't want to have it too far anterior, which can lead to reaming out the tibial tubercle, disruption of the extensor mechanism, which is a disastrous complication. Remember, an excessive medial insertion point leads to valgus malalignment, and this is something that you want to avoid once again, especially with these fractures that are prone to this malunion. All right, so intramedullary nailing, we just went over the starting point. If you start too medially, what happens? Well, you can get more of a valgus deformity distally. You want to have a perfect starting point for these fractures. Spend that extra time, get that perfect starting point. You want to be proximal to the anterior edge, right? You don't want to be in the joint. The idea is also to sometimes use a more lateral starting point, may decrease valgus deformity. This is one of the techniques I would want to, I like to stress, just get the starting point right. Because sometimes you don't want to err one side or the other and cause further issues. All right, next question. To be the most effective preventing the post-operative sagittal plane deformity, what's the post-operative sagittal plane deformity? I think all of us should be shouting out apex anterior or procurvatum. Polar blocking screws should be placed at which location? Okay, so remember, you're trying to prevent that apex anterior. When you think about polar blocking screws, you want to place the screw where you don't want the nail to go. We talked about the osteology of the proximal tibia. It's wide proximally. And what you would like to do is actually take that width and decrease it. And by using a polar blocking screw, you're effectively decreasing the width of the proximal tibia to get further cortical contact, but the cortical contact will be with the screw. So the most appropriate position for blocking screws is going to be mediolateral screws placed on the concave side of the deformity and posterior to the nail. You want the nail to hit it. The thing is, if you can't remember concave, convex, don't worry. Geometry is a long time for us. Just remember, you put a blocking screw where you do not want the nail to go. Hence, it blocks the nail. In terms of a polar blocking screw, it will prevent procurvatum deformity. One may also need one to prevent the valgus deformity as well. Other modalities, once again, include a semi-extended knee position as unicortical plating and also joystick manipulation of the proximal fracture fragment. So, next question. When treating a proximal tibia fracture, the surgeon decides to one, use blocking screws in the proximal fragment. So, we already talked about this, apex anterior or procurvatum valgus deformity. Pick the intramedullary nail based on the location of the Hertzsprung curve. Which of the following combinations will best prevent this classic deformity associated with this fracture? So you should also already be thinking about this. Hopefully the answer comes to most people pretty quickly, and that's going to be place blocking screws lateral and posterior to the nail, right? Because you want to prevent those two deformities, and use a nail that has a Hertzsprung curve proximal to the fracture site. So remember the two deformities, apex anterior, valgus malalignment. The blocking screw should be placed on the concavity of the deformity, thus posterior and lateral to the nail, right? You want to take that metaphyseal diaphyseal mismatch. You want to make that the metaphysis actually smaller and use blocking screws to control the nail. All right, so surgical technique, fracture reduction. This is often tested, often used in practice, blocking or polar screws. Many questions have always been done on this, and we've all many times seen many iterations of these questions. So the corona blocking screw will be placed in the posterior half of the proximal fragment. It prevents the apex anterior deformity. Okay, so we saw that a couple questions ago. And then the sagittal blocking screw will prevent valgus deformity. It's placed on the concave segment as well, so on the lateral side. And it can also enhance the construct stability if not removed. And oftentimes, I will not remove these, and I think most surgeons will keep them in as long as they are doing what they're supposed to do. And this is a JOT study in 1999, studying the mechanical effects of blocking screws or polar screws and stabilizing tibia fractures with short proximal or distal fragments. So once again, this can be used on proximal tibia fractures, distal tibia, distal femur, even proximal femur as well. The study suggests that medial and lateral block screws can increase the primary stability of the distal and proximal metaphyseal fractures after nailing and can be effective tools for selected cases that exhibit malalignment and or instability. So basically enhances your construct and prevents malalignment. So very important to know, very important to understand. These are powerful tools in your toolbox. Next question. 28-year-old female is struck by a motor vehicle while crossing the street. So we're thinking more high energy, right? It's not a twist and fall. This is a motor vehicle accident. Proximal tibia fracture. There's some comminution. There's some swelling, soft tissue swelling within the joint. Apex anterior. You can imagine the pull of the extensor mechanism from the patella as you would hyperflex the knee. So what could we have done? We talked about this. We just talked about screws, right? That's one of our things. We could have put the screw in the proximal fragment near the Hertzsprung curve, and this would have helped prevent this deformity. We could have used joysticks and so forth, and a temporary external fixator, application of an anterior unicortical plate. This helps us reduce the fracture and hold it reduced while we place the nail, helps prevent that apex anterior angulation. And this is a great technique to use, especially if there's an open fracture or even if there's not. Many times if this is just done carefully in order to hopefully not disrupt too much of the periosteum around the fracture site, this can be a very powerful technique in these fractures as well as many others you will encounter before nailing. Many people use different plates. Sometimes they're using a short 1/3 tibular plate, recon plate. It all depends on the soft tissues and where exactly you want to make your wound. It could be anterior, anterior medially, posterior medially. I like to avoid direct anterior just because of the tibial tubercle. And then you can secure it just provisionally. It doesn't have to be absolutely rigid because you're going to stabilize the fracture further with a nail. Universal distractor can also be used. Shantz pins, a femoral distractor. The pins can be used as basically blocking screws while you're doing the case, but then obviously those are removed so they're not stability screws as we looked at earlier. This is another for nail insertion. Think about standard insertion for intramedullary nail is going to be the knee and flexion. As we talked about, we're going to be hyperflexing the knee so we can get the correct starting point. Nail insertion semi-extended may help prevent apex anterior procurvatum. Once again, it needs to be done correctly. It doesn't matter if you just nail this fracture semi-extended. It's not going to magically counteract the deforming forces, but it can help you if done properly. So locking screws, I like to usually lock it both proximally and distally for rotational stability for the nail, and that's what's really recommended. Usually for proximal fractures, you need at least two locking screws proximally, but some implants allow you to have three or even four, depending on the fracture pattern, these might be necessary. So once again, male union, we went over this several times, but just one more time, right? Let's get this, should be hopefully stuck in all of our brains now. 20 to 60% rate of male union following intramedullary nailing and the valgus procurvatum for proximal third tibia fractures. The treatment for the male unions are not easy. It can be revision, intramedullary nailing, or osteotomy and plating. Prevention, blocking screws, temporary plating, universal distractors, Shantz pins, nailing in the semi-extended position, once again, if done correctly.
That's all for this review on proximal third tibia fractures. If you would like access to the full video version of these core webinars, sign up for the OrthoBullets core curriculum today. There will be a link in the show notes for anyone who is interested. Look out for questions related to this topic on this weekend's question session, and hopefully this episode will have prepared you for that review. Thanks so much for listening. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. See you all tomorrow.